Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois, coming to you this December Sunday in 2006. Today we have a guest talking to us about a corner of the world that doesn't get a great deal of attention in the U.S. news media, but is one of the most extraordinary regions in the world for political developments in the past 5 or 10 years. I'm talking about Latin America. Our guest today will be a frequent guest here on Media Matters, Mark Weisbrot, talking about recent elections and politics in South and Central America. So join us today on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
More than 400 people packed the auditorium of the Seattle Public Library on November 30th to tell Democrat Federal Communications Commissioners Jonathan Adelstein and Michael Copps not to allow a rollback of regulations that prevent further concentration of radio, TV, and newspaper ownership. Concerned citizen Margaret Swartzman says although only 2 of the 5 FCC members cared enough to come to Seattle, the burden is on them to take the public interest to heart.
The other commissioners besides yourself are acting kind of like the overseer in a plantation, and they have shackled us, the public, and they've handed the chains over to the plantation owner of corporate America. Please resist them.
The FCC's next official public hearing on media ownership takes place on December 11th at Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee, where a broad-based coalition, including several country music stars like George Jones and Naomi Judd, are expected to add their voices to the national opposition mounting against more media consolidation. This groundswell has spurred 9 senators who oversee the FCC to write Chairman Kevin Martin, urging him to complete work on studies of localism and media diversity begun 3 years ago before moving ahead with any rule changes. It has also convinced at least 1 media executive to declare any plans to loosen restrictions on media ownership DOA for at least the next several years, but only time will tell.
A bit more information has come out about whom the FCC has picked to produce 10 important studies on media ownership. Several of the scholars and researchers selected to perform the work have little to no experience in media analysis, and some of them may have questionable biases. The most concerning selection is Jeffrey Milo, an associate professor of economics at the University of Missouri. He's been contracted to produce what may be the most important study of the 10, an analysis of the effect of the joint ownership of newspapers and television stations on local news coverage. Free Press Research Director Derek Turner says Milo's track record in this area is frankly laughable.
Hasn't done any work in media with the exception of 2 papers he authored on media bias, and his results are absurd on their face. His conclusion is that all media that he studied, with the exception of Brit Hume's show on Fox News and the Washington Times, are all liberally biased. And he came up with some absurd results, such as the Drudge Report is a liberal publication, and the most liberal publication of all he found was the Wall Street Journal.
Additionally, a firm named CRA International has been contracted to produce a study on radio ownership and programming diversity. CRA International is best known for its research of antitrust issues, and its client roster covers a wide swath of corporate America, including such media giants as ABC, NBC, and Viacom. Sources on Capitol Hill say the FCC has documentation on just how it selected the people and firms it did to perform these studies, and this information includes how much they're getting paid for their services, but the agency's keeping that information under wraps for now. The biggest fear is that these selections were made with predetermined research outcomes in mind. Visit StopBigMedia.com to make your voice heard to the FCC on this and other important media ownership issues.
Here's another reason to come to the National Conference for Media Reform in Memphis, Tennessee next month. Party down with the SaveTheInternet.com Coalition. They've rented out the Gibson Guitar Factory for the night of January 11th. There's certainly a lot to celebrate. 9 months ago, nobody had even heard of the term network neutrality, and big phone and cable companies were spending tens of millions of dollars to push telecom legislation through Congress that would have effectively gutted internet freedom. But a massive online mobilization of citizen resistance featuring more than 1.2 million people and counting beat back that juggernaut. Free Press campaign director Tim Carr says it's now time to think about the future.
It's not just ensuring net neutrality, but it's also working to make sure that there's more competition in markets. People have more choices, and the broadband services that they choose are faster and cheaper and built out into communities that to date have not been properly served.
It's still not too late to sign up for the National Conference for Media Reform itself, which begins the following day on January 12th. A special discount rate for bloggers is available. Visit www.freepress.net/conference to find out more and sign up to be there. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois, coming to you today from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Today we have as our guest the executive director or co-director for the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., Mark Weisbrot, an economist, co-author of the book on Social Security with Dean Baker in 2000, and an expert on Latin American politics and media coverage of Latin America. A columnist himself, Mark Weisbrot writes widely on a broad range of economic and political issues with an emphasis on Latin America. Mark, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you, Bob.
Well, your beat's been pretty active the last few months in Latin America. A series of elections have taken place with dramatic results. And there's really a change of brewing in the region. We've talked about this on the program before, Mark. But, I mean, I recall as recently as maybe a decade ago, and certainly in the early 1990s, when someone talked about Latin America, but all you heard about was how the free market system had taken over, the liberals, the left, all those sorts of politics had been purged, and that it was a region that was about to be integrated into sort of the U.S. Economic model, and everyone was, in the U.S. media at least, was going to live happily ever after. It hasn't quite turned out that way, has it?
No, in fact, you've had now 11 elections in the past 8 years where you had a challenger who, a left populist challenger, who explicitly challenged what they call neoliberalism in Latin America, which is the general word there for the economic changes. You know, we never use free market at CEPR because it's not accurate as a description of what these changes are, because very often they're against competition and even free trade. But in any case, the whole set of reforms, the Washington Consensus, and out of those 11 races, in eight of them, and that's not including Chavez's re-election or Lula's re-election, just counting them once. Chavez has been elected three times, plus the recall referendum. In eight of those 11 races, the left candidate won, and the other three, they were very close. In Mexico, where we don't really know who won because of the irregularities in that election, and it was very close. In Costa Rica, where it was also 1.2 percentage points, and then in Peru, also very close election. So the left is definitely winning, and they're winning. What you're really seeing here is a set of really failed economic policies. When I say failure, it doesn't mean I don't like them. It means that by any objective economic measure, and of course the most important and simplest measure, which is simply economic growth, these reforms have failed. You've had now 25 years of the worst economic growth performance in more than a century, a long-term failure that's not very common even in the whole history of capitalism. And what is happening is that the people are going over their leaders' heads, their politicians, their institutions, their economists, and voting for these changes because their leaders refuse to respond. You know, I would even put the U.S. election, the last U.S. election, partly in that category, too, although the economic failure here has been of a different order. It's been distributional rather than growth. But a similar thing happened, I think, on November 7th here.
We're talking to Mark Weisbrot from the Center for Economic and Policy Research here on Media Matters. We're discussing, in particular, developments in Latin America economically and politically, and the press coverage of Latin American developments in the U.S. news media. Mark Weisbrot is joining us a few days before going on air, so please don't call in. And let us do the talking today. Sit back and relax. But it is right before going on air, because we are able to talk about the re-election of President Hugo Chavez in Venezuela last week on Sunday. Now, Venezuela has gotten the most attention in the U.S. news media of all the Latin American countries, of all the countries that have elected anti-neoliberal, even in the case of Chavez and Correa and a few of the others, explicitly socialist, at least in philosophy, self-proclaimed socialist governments in the last few years. And what is it about Venezuela, do you think, Mark, that accounts for the notoriety or acclaim that Chavez has gotten in the United States? Is it, and what is actually going on in Venezuela that demands our attention?
Well, I think Chavez has changed the whole history of the hemisphere quite drastically. I mean, he's contributed to that more than anyone, although I think Néstor Kirchner of Argentina has also done so, but more quietly. But what Chavez has done for the hemisphere is he's supplied, and his government, I don't want to personalize like the media does here, because in fact there is a government there, and Chavez does not control all of it as is often portrayed here. And, you know, the Congress, for example, debates things and does things on their own quite often. And the what he's done is, most importantly for the rest of the hemisphere, is he's provided an alternative source of financing. Venezuela has $36 billion in reserves, so he's loaned $2.5 billion to Argentina when they wanted to get rid of the IMF. He's loaned hundreds of millions to Bolivia so that Bolivia does not have to listen to the United States or the IMF or the World Bank. He's loaned money to Ecuador, even under the previous government, and will guarantee the viability of the latest, of the new left government led by someone who's got his PhD in economics from the University of Illinois in Urbana, I should mention.
Indeed.
Rafael Correa. And so this is a huge thing, because people don't understand this because it's never in the press, but the major instrument of control and influence of the United States in Latin America and in developing countries generally has been a control over credit, a kind of monopoly, which was headed by the IMF and set up so that if you didn't obey the IMF conditions, you didn't get money from the much larger World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, regional banks, USAID, the G7 governments, and sometimes even the private sector. So it was this power that enabled the United States to impose these reforms that you mentioned earlier, not only on Latin America, but, again, other developing countries. And this power has disappeared. Now, there were other things that pushed this, that broke this monopoly, but in Latin America, there's no doubt that Chavez played a leading role there. And the other thing he's done was to provide an example of a left government that delivered the goods, you know, which is a very important thing. I mean, we vote here. We very often don't get what we voted for in Latin America. It's the same problem. And Chavez came to power and promised to share the country's oil wealth with the poor, who had gotten very little from it in 40 years. And he did it. They have, you know, free health care for, you know, the vast majority of people, poor people. They have 47% get subsidized food and vastly increased access to education just all in the last few years. And that, not to mention the economy, is also booming. It's been the fastest growing economy in the hemisphere for the last 3 years. So
I've got a confession to make to you right now, Mark Weisbrot. I'm having cognitive dissonance. And the reason is what you've just said makes no sense to me based on the U.S. news media reports I've been getting on Venezuela for the past few weeks. I've been reading about people leaving the country because they educated people can't find work. You're telling me there's a booming economy. I've been reading about Venezuela becoming the murder capital of the world. You're telling me about a government that's very popular. What's wrong with the picture?
Well, if you read everything, you can find all the things that I've told you. I mean, the business press talks about the booming economy. It tends to bury it, and it tends to pretend. I think in that area, they say that it's just an oil boom, you know, and it's going to go bust. And that's grossly exaggerated as well. For example, you've had other periods of oil booms, and the economy did not do that well at all. And they certainly didn't provide any of these benefits for poor people. And also, it's not vulnerable to very vulnerable to a decline in the price of oil, which you see every day in the media. They say, oh, when the oil price comes down, the Venezuelan economy is going to collapse. It's just not true mathematically. It would have to crash below levels that anybody is anticipating, because the government has been quite conservative. They've budgeted for oil, and their budget at $26 a barrel last year, and it came in at over twice that. So, you know, these are the kind of bad reporting that you see. But it really is worse than that. The crime is a very serious problem, but then it gets exaggerated. So there was an article in the New York Times just a week or so ago, and the headline was "Killings Rattle Journalists in Venezuela." And if you just read the headline, didn't read the article carefully, you'd get the impression that journalists are somehow afraid of their lives because of their work. But in fact, there were only four journalists that were killed in the last, five journalists in the last 4 years. And the article grudgingly made it clear that there was no evidence that any of these murders were political or related to what these journalists were writing. And in fact, the number of journalists killed is less than you would expect from their number in the population. So these are the kind of articles that you see. I mean, there was no purpose to that article except to get that headline down in the Venezuelan press, where it's mostly controlled by the opposition, and they could say, look, the New York Times says, you know, that journalists are being murdered, and to give you the bad impression that you get. Now, I could go through this for, you know, the entire hour, because the media coverage of Venezuela is, as one of my friends described it, he worked for the Associated Press for 8 years in Venezuela, and he described it as atrocious.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the real weaknesses of it, I mean, that you've seen from your experience in Venezuela and covering Venezuela?
What are the big weaknesses?
Yeah, what have been the real problems? What are Americans not learning, or what are they getting the wrong picture about?
Yeah.
How are they being misled?
Yeah, well, you know, when I went there in 2002 during the oil strike, I met with almost all the U.S. journalists, and there were a couple things they admitted to me. And one was, they all admitted to me, and these were the major papers and wire services. And they said, first, that people in the United States have a very false impression of Venezuela. They think it's some kind of dictatorship, when in fact it is not. It's a democracy. And that's the biggest thing, I think. And, you know, this is where you get this really false impression. You know, Venezuela has the most oppositional media in the entire hemisphere, possibly the world. I mean,
possibly, you know, in world history, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know, because I don't know. There's probably governments that were about to fall, you know, that had medias where they trashed them all day long, every day. You know, and Chavez's response to that was not to censor. There's been no censorship of the media in his whole almost 8 years, except, of course, when the opposition censored the media during the military coup. You know, what his response has been, the government's response, is create two state TV channels. And, you know, they only get maybe a quarter of the market, but that's their response, you know, is to compete with them instead, rather than trying to censor them. And it is a serious problem. This is a problem you don't read about in the U.S. press, because what the Venezuelan media does, besides their stuff spilling over into the international press, is they've managed to create an alternate universe. So, for example, in the latest polling, you know, you had, okay, you pre-election polls showed 36% of the people were voting for Rosales, the opposition candidate, and 36% believed that Rosales was going to win. Now, why did they believe that? Well, because the media there didn't report the Associated Press show poll, which just a few days ago, a week ago, showed Chavez up by 22 points, or the Zogby poll, which showed him up by 29 points. I mean, these were the reputable polls. They printed polls, you know, fake polls, and they ignored the good, you know, the more accurate ones. And so they did this fairly deliberately, not just to give their candidate a boost, but also to create a climate where people would be ready to go to the streets. Now, it turns out they didn't, because they really lost, and they lost, and they could not do it, you know, and Rosales wouldn't go along. But if you look at 2004, where Chavez won by a similar margin in the recall referendum, they actually maintained, and they still maintain to this day, that election was an electronic fraud. You know, a vast conspiracy theory that, you know, the Carter Center, the OAS, all of them were either in on it or somehow missed it. This is the mentality you have there, and it's this election was actually different, you know, in the sense that it's breaking down and they're going to recognize the result. But this is the kind of story you don't get in the U.S. media here, how the real problem of democracy in Venezuela is more from the opposition side, where they refused to participate, they boycotted the December elections, they had no reason to boycott those elections, the OAS and the European Union heavily criticized them for that. And, you know, you can get bits and pieces of this, but the slant is so overwhelming that the impression that you get is quite false if you don't read every single word.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Let's keep with Venezuela if we can for a little bit while longer, Mark. Chavez proclaimed himself a socialist. He has professed admiration for Cuba and what Cuba has done. What are the economics of Venezuela? Is this a socialist economy by economic terms? And
no.
Then also follow that up with discussing the relationship with Cuba.
Well, it's not a socialist economy by any means, and I don't think Chavez would claim that it is. He does claim that he wants to move in that direction. And it's interesting, you see polls there when people are asked would they prefer a socialist economy. It's a plurality that says yes, actually. The problem is the state doesn't have the capacity to move very much even in the direction of planning in a capitalist system. And so change has been gradual in that regard. The private sector is still a larger proportion of the economy than it was before Chavez took office. So the government hasn't had the capacity to do that for a variety of reasons. What they've done, well, first of all, they've only had political stability for about 3.5 years. They couldn't do it. They were fighting for survival because the opposition kept trying to overthrow the government through a military coup, through a devastating oil strike in 2002-2003. And so they really couldn't get anything done until the last few years is when they began the misiones, the social missions, to provide food and health care and education. So they're trying to take care of the basics first. They've made some significant accomplishments there. There's still a way to go. You still have a third of the population below the poverty line, but it's still a significant improvement. And I think you do have some, the closest you would get to what he would, you know, what people would call social, maybe the cooperatives. You have about 5% of the labor force in cooperatives now. These are things that are financed by the government. If you want to get a loan to start a cooperative enterprise, you can do that there in many places. And but again, I think it remains to be seen what kind of a mixed economy the government is going to move towards in the next 6 years.
Now, what about Cuba, which is in U.S. news media, Chavez and Castro, Venezuela and Cuba? I wouldn't say they're used interchangeably, but they're certainly put together as you know, birds of the same feather.
Well, first of all, as I said, you know, the civil liberties and press freedoms in Venezuela are
you know, about the level we have here, actually more in some ways. So it's not, obviously it's not like Cuba at all. Chavez has said that himself, actually, that it's not going to be like Cuba, although he's very close to Fidel Castro, and they have a relationship which is very mutually beneficial. Obviously, Venezuela provides oil and economic support to Cuba, and Cuba has provided many things, including 20,000 doctors that enabled them to have this health care system because their own doctors didn't really want to go to the barrios and participate in anything like this. So this is the relationship. It's a close political relationship. But, you know, I don't think that this is anything, this really has much to do with the U.S., the conflict between the United States and Venezuela, because that's played up a lot in the press. But, you know, Lula and the Workers' Party in Brazil, for example, have a long-standing relation to Cuba that goes way back much further. And that's, you know, they've just agreed to disagree with
then,
the United
then what
States.
Is the basis, in your view, of the hostility of the U.S. government and seemingly politicians from both the Democratic and Republican Party toward Chavez and Venezuelan government, if not Cuba?
Well, there are a number of things. I think one is that it's a big oil producer. And, you know, there's a myth here even among, I think, the progressive community that the United States foreign policy is somehow driven by our need for oil. That if we, you know, if we reduced our energy dependence, we wouldn't have oil, and we wouldn't have so many wars, you know, or interventions in the Middle East. And I don't think this is really true. I think what we're seeing is that oil states are very important because they can. It's a source of funding and independence and. This is what our government really objects to, and you can see it as I described at the beginning of the show. They lost control over one oil producer in Latin America, and it really has contributed to an enormous loss of control over the entire region. So that's the big thing. They just didn't want a non-compliant government in control of this kind of oil resources.
How extensive are Venezuela's oil reserves?
Huge. In fact, they may be re-evaluated this year, and it could, if you count all the heavy crude, which is, you know, it's difficult to estimate how much that is worth in terms compared to the other oil. They could come in higher than Saudi Arabia. They could be the first in the world. In terms of actual reserves.
So this would be the revenues generated by this oil, assuming Chavez continues to win elections, could do a lot of damage from the U.S. government perspective and giving independence to countries like Ecuador and Mexico, perhaps, or Bolivia.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was in Bolivia February. And, you know, this is a country that was under IMF agreements for 20 years straight with just an eight-month break. Terrible failure, of course. Per capita income lower than it's been than it was 25 years ago. And, you know, one of the first questions that came up when I met with the government officials was, well, what's going to happen with the IMF? And their agreement expired in March. And it turned out, well, you know, the IMF was there, and they said, no, we don't need an agreement. Now, this is a poor country. This isn't, you know, Venezuela or Argentina.
Now, is this after the Morales election?
Yeah.
And maybe explain to our listeners what the significance of that election was.
Well, this was huge in many ways, but it was a left progressive leader, the movement towards socialism. This is a party, an indigenous leader, the first indigenous president ever in that country and in probably the hemisphere since, you know, several hundred years. And he won with a large majority for Bolivia, which was unprecedented because it's usually quite divided. So the, you know, the big question there was, you know, is he going to be able to deliver on the on his promises to the majority of the country, which is poor and which is also indigenous, and there's a high correlation between those two things. And they have been doing it. You know, they in May they carried through on their promise to nationalize the gas and oil, which is their major source of revenue. Even before Morales took power in May 2005, there was a hydrocarbons law that captured billions of dollars of revenue for the government. So they're already starting as well to you know, provide some of the things they promised: access, increased access to water, increased access to health care and education. And So one of the reasons, again, they were able to do this is because they have a source of revenue. And the United States hasn't cut them off. Nobody's cut them off. The Europeans didn't cut them off. Now, in the past, the IMF agreement would have been the determining factor. Even the European grants, European Union grants, were dependent on IMF approval. But that's gone now. And now it's an independent government, and they can do what they want. And that is part of the huge, these are epic-making changes in Latin America. There's been nothing like this for, you know, over 100 years.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Mark Weisbrot, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research based in Washington, D.C. Mark Weisbrot is a journalist, an economist who's written books and writes frequently. You can find his material at cepr.net or .org.
.net.
And he writes widely, especially in Latin American politics, where he travels frequently, and really an expert on Latin American economics as well, and press coverage as a working journalist. We've been talking about Venezuela. We've been talking about Bolivia. Sit back, relax, enjoy the rest of the show. We taped the show a few days before going on air, so don't try to call in today. Let us do the yakking. There have been some other elections recently in Latin America. This seems to be the election season down there. Ecuador comes to mind, as you've referred to already. What is the significance of the Ecuadorian election?
Well, I think that's very big. It's very big. This is, again, a left candidate, Rafael Correa, who I mentioned before, an economist who's written about exactly the problems we talked about, the economic failures in Latin America, and he ran on a very populist program. And it was quite interesting. I mean, the media and the international press really went after him. They called him an ally, and all the headlines called him an ally of Chavez, even though he'd only met with Chavez once. But this was kind of the right wing and the U.S. strategy in Latin America since the Mexican and the Peruvian election earlier this year. They thought this is the winning strategy. If we can taint this guy by saying that he, you know, and it's kind of this whole Cold War framework as well that the media presents and the State Department has presented, where you have Chavez and Castro, and they usually throw Evo Morales in there, and this is kind of the axis of countries that are anti-U.S. they call them, which is another bad label actually when you think about it, because Chavez is providing hundreds of thousands of people in the United States with discounted heating oil, for example. And is very explicit in not being against the U.S. In fact, he likes this country very much. So this is what they've presented. It didn't work. And that was the most amazing thing. And Correa was very strong. He said, sure, I'm a friend of Chavez, and what's wrong with that? I like the social programs that he's done in Venezuela. And Venezuela is a democracy. He said that very strongly. He argued with the TV interviewers. And he didn't back off at all. And of course, in Ecuador, surveys showed that about 86% of the population actually admires Chavez, so it wasn't probably going to hurt him there. But still, and then the most amazing thing, he ran on a program of saying that we might have to renegotiate the debt, which nobody does. I mean, it's basically you're talking about default. The bond markets, reacted violently to his statements, and he still won. Won by a large margin. Much
he's running against like some gazillionaire guy, right?
Yeah. I forgot to mention that he was running against the richest man in the country, a billionaire, Alvaro Noboa, the banana magnate, and owns over 100 businesses in the country. And so it was an amazing example of democracy, where people went to the polls and voted for someone in spite of all the establishment being against him. And in spite of the fact that, he was very clear about his relations with the U.S., he said he would oppose the so-called free trade agreement that the United States was proposing with Ecuador, that he would get rid of the military base in Manta, which is the last remaining base in U.S. base in South America, and nobody wanted it there. And he even made some choice remarks about President Bush when Chavez made his speech in September at the United Nations, where he referred to President Bush as the devil. They asked Correa about it, and he said, "Well, it was an insult to the devil," and went on to say that Bush was a tremendously dim-witted president, done enormous damage in the world. And, I'll tell you, the interesting thing is that just last Thursday, I think it was, President Bush actually called Correa to congratulate him on his victory. And so it shows, again, that the United States at this moment has so little influence right now in Latin America that it is not really challenging these governments, at least not up front. Now, below the surface, you have these so-called democracy promotion programs in Bolivia and Venezuela, especially. You have some of these. We can talk about that if you want. But
yeah, the U.S. has this program?
Yeah, and, the most ominous one is called the Office of Transition Initiatives, which is a USAID program that's kind of that's only in places like Afghanistan normally, but they have it in Venezuela and Bolivia. But they have all these. They've put hundreds of millions of dollars in to these programs, and in Venezuela especially, people that were funded by USAID and NED and other U.S. government agencies were involved in the coup. They were involved in other destabilization efforts. So you have that kind of stuff going on under the table. That's the stuff the media almost never writes about, very, very rarely, and they completely whitewashed the whole role of the United States in the coup in Venezuela, which is now well documented because these documents have been released under the Freedom of Information Act. And you've had one article in the New York Times which was good and described it, and one in Newsday, and that's pretty much, that's almost it. They really try, you see every day in the media they say Chavez accuses the United States of being involved in this coup. Well, that's not an accusation. It's like saying, I accuse the Federal Reserve of raising interest rates to 5.25%. This is a fact, established fact. And so these are the kind of things that our government continues to do, it's very destabilizing. But what I'm just emphasizing on the other side, just to to give the overall picture, is that the U.S. government has not cut off anything to Bolivia. And in fact, the White House recommended an extension of their trade preferences under the Andean Trade Promotion and Drug Eradication Act, which they didn't have to do, and Congress will probably approve it. So they don't—they're not trying to use pressures. They know that it will just backfire. If they want to threaten Bolivia, they'll just get more of their financing from Venezuela. Same is true for Ecuador. Same is true for really anybody in Latin America.
So the United States basically has to do a little more carrot and a little less stick?
They have to, yeah. Well, they don't really do much in the way of carrots. They just really are losing. They're losing influence at a very rapid pace. Their last card is really the covert stuff, and that's why they have increased quite a bit the funding for these so-called democracy promotion programs.
Well, the big cheeses in Latin America, population-wise, the most powerful nations, a more respectful way to put it, Brazil and Mexico, by far the two most populous nations, and historically probably along with those two, the most important political and economic force in Latin America has been Argentina. And I'd like to talk about those three countries, if we could, in the remainder of this show, Mark Weisbrot. Let's start with Brazil, where Lula has won re-election just recently again. And Lula came in, I think, at one time when elected, was regarded in a manner not unlike Chavez as a from the Workers' Party, a candidate of the left. What has been the Lula experience in Brazil, a nation, one of the most populous in the world, dominates Latin America population-wise, 180 million or so people. What has been the Lula record?
Yes. Well, you know, we do have papers on this. I just want to mention for your audience on the website at cepr.net, we did these kind of background papers on the economic issues for all these elections, so we have one on Brazil as well. And basically, Lula was faced kind of with a choice when he came in, whether he was going to take on the financial sector, which is a very powerful sector in Brazil and was backed by these international financial institutions, and try to pursue a different kind of economic strategy. The biggest problem in Brazil, of course, is they've had very slow growth as well the last 25 years, you know, about 0.5% annually per capita, which is terrible. And in order to break out of that, that's the main reason you have this kind of poverty. You know, if they had just grown at the rate that they grew prior to 1980, the country would be have the living standards of Europe. So this is the major economic failure, and this is what people were hoping. And he did not do that. He stuck to the orthodox policies. They really extremely high interest rates, for example. They're still at 13.25% right now, their federal overnight rate compared to our federal funds rate. And their inflation is lower than in the United States. So this is a very, very high interest rate, and this is crippling the economy. And so they've had slow growth, and they haven't been able to do very much. He did, however, spend about 0.25% of GDP increasing the payments to poor families in the countryside, also raised the minimum wage. So that was enough to get him reelected, in spite of the big corruption scandals that the country had and everything else. So it's not like the government has been a failure in the sense of not delivering anything.
Do you think, Mark Weisbrot, that now that Venezuela has had such success and Bolivia's come along, that Lula or someone else, if not Lula, could come in and perhaps now exercise greater independence than Lula seemed to feel he was able to exercise?
Well, I'm cautiously optimistic about Brazil. You know, they paid off their IMF debt, so they don't have that anymore. They have very good relations with Venezuela. This is another place where the media really distorts the picture. They're always trying to make it look like Chavez is isolated among his neighbors. And because that's the goal of, you know, U.S. foreign policy. But it's really quite wrong. I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, Lula went to Venezuela, and it was his first foreign trip after being reelected in his own reelection by a large margin. And he praised Chavez and presided over, in the middle of Chavez's, you know, presidential reelection campaign, he presided over the inauguration of a $1.2 billion bridge that was financed by the Brazilian government and basically endorsed, for all practical purposes, endorsed Chavez for his reelection. So they have a good relationship. This is a good question because, you know, will they change their economic policy and have the kind of development strategy or even macroeconomic policies that would allow them to have the growth that they had in the past? It's not in the cards right now, but I think it is a possibility. He has a new finance minister who is much better than the old one. The old one was kind of the Karl Rove of that administration. The new one is from the left. Unfortunately, the central bank is still controlled by somebody from the center-right party, not from Lula's party. And so that's the most important policy position in the government. So, but it is internal. I say, you know, this is the difference, I think. If Brazil decides to go in a different direction, it won't. There won't be any real impediments from the international financial institutions or from the United States as there have been in the past. And that is the big difference.
I mean, that's really, if you think about it, given the size of Brazil, it's one of the about six or seven most populous countries in the world. And it's relatively large economy, therefore, or absolutely large economy, therefore. If it were to move in that direction with Venezuela, with the other nations of the region, that would be quite an extraordinary development, wouldn't it?
Well, it already has been, in the sense their foreign policy has moved. I mean, they stood up, they were one of the leaders standing up to the United States at the World Trade Organization in 2003, where the developing countries basically walked out of the negotiations. They stood up to the United States on the free trade area of the Americas, and together with Venezuela and Argentina, they basically killed that. They've had the Mercosur countries, which includes Uruguay and Paraguay, in addition to Argentina and Brazil, and now Venezuela, they all supported Venezuela's bid for the Security Council, which didn't get much press coverage either, but I thought that was a really historic event.
Please talk about that. The only press coverage that got that I could see, for the most part, was basically, you know, this was the equivalent of maybe, you know, Dom DeLuise auditioning for the job.
The
idea that Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, would be allowed to be on the Security Council of the UN.
Yeah, well, that was another place where the press, I think, didn't give it an honest coverage, because the emphasis was on Chavez lost, but he got the vast majority of Latin America behind him, and it was despite all this amazing pressure from the United States, and everybody knows. And it was a good article, actually, in the San Francisco Chronicle about that. It was very good. About how, the United States listens in on everybody's phone calls and spies on everyone there. Everyone knows that. The UN. So they had a huge advantage over Venezuela in that they could actually punish people for voting for Chavez, whereas Chavez could only say, okay, he got all these people to say they vote for him, but they, it's a secret ballot. So he couldn't know whether they did or not. Not that he's made any of his, that government, Venezuela hasn't made their financial aid contingent on any political conditions. That's one big difference between them and the United States and Latin America as well. But in any case, it was pretty amazing that they got these countries really told, it was a huge slap in the face to Bush, and it was before this latest election where he's much weaker now after November 7th. He was pleading and threatening with everybody not to support Venezuela for the Security Council, and they mostly did it. And he lost because a lot of the countries that were afraid voted against him.
Now, you've talked about Argentina earlier, the Néstor Kirchner government. Now, this is not a government, to my knowledge, that is routinely clumped in together with Chavez. So explain to our listeners, if you would, Mark Weisbrot, a little bit more about what has been going on in Argentina, and maybe give a little bit of background to the fiscal crisis that the Argentine economy experienced, 5-6 years ago.
Yes, well, I think this is important because, I don't think the progressive community has recognized the contributions of Kirchner and that government. It's not a left government like Chavez government, for example, or Evo Morales. But they did something extremely important. They stood up to the IMF. They defaulted on the $100 billion worth of debt, the largest sovereign debt default in history, which was absolutely necessary at the time. That was at the beginning of 2002. And they implemented a set of macroeconomic policies that were unorthodox, and they had to fight everybody to do that. And they won. I mean, this economy has grown. Now it's approaching 5 years at over 8% annually, tied with Venezuela for the fastest growing economy in the hemisphere for much of that time, and they pulled 8 million people across the poverty line, and the government is immensely popular. He's also very popular with the human rights groups because he's prosecuting the government is prosecuting these people who murdered people during the 1976 to 83 dictatorship, which previous governments, gave them immunity. And this is it's really also changed the history of the hemisphere and the world, actually, because this was kind of the final nail in the coffin of IMF influence in middle-income countries. And so they deserve a lot of credit for that. And you haven't seen that here because Kirchner is more provincial, he's more quiet, although not about the IMF. I mean, their government openly denounced the IMF and published papers about how they destroyed the Argentine economy and everything else, and accused them of everything.
What are Kirchner's relations like with Morales in Bolivia, with Lula in Brazil, with the Chavez government in Venezuela?
Very good relations with all of them. In fact, they just reached a settlement with Bolivia on the gas that Bolivia exports to Argentina, which is very important, when Bolivia, of course, nationalized it. Relations with Chavez are very good. They have the same... They all have a common strategy of kind of regional political independence and regional economic integration. And that's why I say these changes are so significant, because you're going to see a whole different future for South America than you would have seen if not for these elections.
Let's move for a second, Mark Weisbrot, in our rapid tour of Latin America and Latin American politics. It's just, again, an extraordinary region of the world. I wish we could do this show once a month. I consider the area so important for what's going on in the world today. And turn somewhat to the north, to Central America, or North America, to Mexico, the second largest economy in Latin America, and one certainly best known to Americans. They've just had a highly controversial presidential election, and Calderon was just inaugurated this last week. What's your sense of the Mexican political situation and what its future holds?
Well, there's a lot of turmoil there, and I can't go into it all now. You know, it's a pity that I know your show is more about media, and I could tell you so many stories about the media coverage of all of these things we're talking about. Maybe we could do another show sometime where we just talked about that. But Mexico is the perfect example, because that election had very serious irregularities, and we did several papers on it. And there were two points that the media really missed that are extremely important to what's understanding what's happening right now with López Obrador and his party refusing to recognize the legitimacy of this government. Now, even though, fraud was never established, and I think, in fairness, I have to say López Obrador has made unsubstantiated claims. Nonetheless, the election was so badly done, about half of the polling places had what we call adding up problems. The number of ballots received by the polling place is supposed to equal the number of ballots cast plus the ones that are left over blank at the end of the day, and this just didn't hold for about half of the polling stations. And the second thing that the media missed entirely, almost, was that the government actually did a partial recount of 9% of the polling places, and they never released the results of it. They did it. They had the results, I think, by August 13th, They never told it, and the press didn't really press them on this. And eventually they released enough so that you could figure out pretty much what happened, and it was just what we actually went through thousands of pages of court documents to find, get an estimate of what was going on that they wouldn't release. And it was because López Obrador, the left candidate, actually picked up quite a number of votes, and Calderon lost them in that partial recount. But that never became an issue. And if it had been reported and had been released, or even if the information that was available had been reported, I think there would have been enormous pressure on the government to have that recount, and we would know who actually won the Mexican election.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to think that if López Obrador had won in such a method as Calderón has apparently assumed won, or at least taken office, if we would be getting more press coverage in the U.S. media about faulty electoral systems than we've been getting in Mexico.
Yeah, and I mean, this was a major failure by the media here. And, I had so many discussions. We had many discussions with the press on this. And it was... it was just very badly reported. And so you're going to have a lot of conflict in Mexico, I think, because this government has a lack of legitimacy. And it's going to get a lot worse because the U.S. economy is, you know, headed towards recession sometime in the next year or so. Mexico exports 85% of its exports go to the United States. So they're hit very hard when the U.S. has a recession. Their economy has been doing fairly well lately. So, you know, you have this level of discontent. Now it's going to get worse when the economy heads south, I think.
Mark Weisbrot, our guest today. We've only got a few minutes left on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. 1 week from today, if you join us, our last guest live on the air will be Howard Zinn, the historian. 2 weeks from today, our guest will be Elizabeth Fones Wolff, author of the new book, Waves of Opposition, Labor and the Struggle for Democratic Radio. So please be sure to join us every Sunday afternoon here in WILL AM 580 for Media Matters. Mark Weisbrot, in our closing moments here, I'd like to turn to some comments you've made already, and you've alluded to some economic issues, and you are an economist by training, and we've had you on the show basically talking about the U.S. economy at length in the past and talking about business journalism in the United States. You mentioned the WTO and the IMF. Where does this whole globalization project that was, you know, in the 1990s, everyone was saying that global capitalism had taken over, that governments couldn't do anything but get out of the way of the market. The WTO is going to come in and set the terms that every country would have to follow and have one huge marketplace for the world. Where does that stand today with all the developments of the last 5 years?
Well, it's definitely collapsed. I mean, the multilateral institutions, for example, the collapse of the IMF that I described so far, I think, is the most important change in the international financial system since the collapse of the Bretton Woods system in 1973, and in fact, it's even more important for low and middle income countries. So that's a huge change. And with that, of course, the World Bank and these other institutions that are allied to the IMF lose power. WTO is also falling apart to a large degree as well. Their whole, you know, the whole Doha development round, as it's called, has pretty much come to a standstill. And it's not clear if they're going to be able to revive it. So, you know, a lot of people think this is bad because they think that these multilateral institutions have a positive role to play. But what they really were, I think, including the WTO, although it's different from the other two, the Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF and the bank, I mean, they really were overwhelmingly imposing a set of economic policies that have never really worked in the history of capitalism. It is policies that the rich countries never followed, like the United States when we were a developing country. You know, we had the highest tariffs in the world from like 1873 to World War One, when we were also the fastest growing economy in the world. And not that tariffs are necessarily good, but the point is we were able to have a development strategy, and every country that has gotten anywhere has had a development strategy. And what these institutions have done is overwhelmingly to prevent countries from pursuing development strategies that have been successful in the past.
And Mark Weisbrot, on that note, I'm afraid we're running out of time. I hear the band tuning up in the background, meaning it's time to clear out of the studio. I want to thank you very much for joining us today in Media Matters. And I look forward to talking to you in the future. People who want to find out more about Mark Weisbrot's work at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, go to cepr.net on the Internet. Mark Weisbrot, again, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Bob.
All right. Good luck with everything. And I'll be back 167 hours from today with Howard Zinn. Thank you very much, everyone. Happy holidays.